You're listening to The Job, a talk show about design, music, business, culture, and Portland, featuring interesting interviews with interesting people, brought to you by Need More Designs. My name is Ray, and I'm joined today by Candace Briglib. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
Today's Monday, April 1st, 2013, and this is episode number 7. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Glad to be back in Portland.
Glad to be back in Portland, yeah. Portland is a beautiful city.
It really is. It's really nice. Let's just take a moment to reflect on how nice Portland is. Mm-hmm. We spent the past week on business in the Twin Cities. That's Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. And I actually basically grew up there, in that area. So it was partly familiar for me and partly new.
What had changed the most for you?
What seemed to me to have changed the most was the sort of on the downtown next to the river, just really...
Minneapolis?
Yeah, in Minneapolis. Yeah. Like, it seemed like it had been, from my recollections before, it was just very, very run down. I don't recall anything being there. And now it's like, you know, the, the Guthrie, which is sort of a legendary theater that, that used to be connected to the Walker Art Center, is now, has this amazing building down there. There's a really, you can cough, it's cool. There's a really great museum. It's cool to look over the stone bridge and see there's like, you know, ruins of flower factories that have exploded.
The Mill Museum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was cool. A nice tour.
The whole area is just really interesting. Just the ruins of the mill and then the super modern buildings.
Yeah, it's like a study in contrast, the architecture. Yeah. Like seeing a really old, like 150-year-old mill ruins right next to like these, you know, fancy, big, beautiful glass structures that kind of almost rose out of them. It was weird.
Out of the ashes.
Now, St. Paul didn't really... We didn't spend much time in St. Paul, but that didn't seem to me to have changed enough.
Didn't change for the better.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, sad but true. The
What is the relationship between those two cities? They're so close.
Well, kind of. I mean, they just sort of grew up on different kind of parts of the Mississippi. So like St. Paul would be a little bit downstream from Minneapolis. So, you know,
but they're not twins. I mean, unless one's the pretty twin and one's the ugly twin.
Right. It's so true. Oh, I feel bad saying that. You know, St. Paul is the state
capital.
Didn't.
It's yeah. Okay.
St. Paul's the state capital. Minneapolis is untethered from legislative interests. So it's free to pursue a pure money. There's a lot of...
St. Paul's the capital?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so... I don't know. It honestly felt more like the difference between Portland and Salem.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. So, yeah.
Sorry,
maybe
Salem.
That's true.
Yeah. I did say that. it's true, though. I mean...
For me, one of the highlights of the trip was... The museum, the Walker Art Museum.
Yeah.
The
Walker
great
was...
place.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. That place is always... And it some of it was under construction. They just kind of kept at it. We didn't really get to explore all that much under the circumstances, but it was nice. I'm glad you got to see it.
Mm-hmm. And the sculpture garden outside was really nice. One of the things that struck me about Minneapolis is... how the city had constructed itself around the frigid coldness, or how, you know, it's like I'd never been to a city where all of the parking is underground in these sort of heated garages, and then there are skyways connecting all the buildings.
Yeah, the heated parking scared the shit out of our daughter the first time it kicked on, because it's like there's this ginormous furnace, you know, in the garage right now, you know, like 50 feet away from us, it all of a sudden just thunders into action. I barely even noticed it because, you know, it's a parking garage in Minnesota. Of course it's heated.
Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it happens.
Yeah, and...
And the Skyway systems. You'd never seen Skyways before.
Never seen a Skyway. I was very excited that I got you to sing the song about Skyways.
Sing a little bit of it,
Would you do that now? Or?
No, I won't be doing that right now, but okay. Maybe we'll throw it in the mix. or link to it or something. Yeah. Okay. Well, today's show features an interview with Trevor Fife. Do you know who Trevor Fife is, Candace?
I do.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, he's the director of photography based here in Portland. Lovely Portland. His varied works include a lot of stuff that you've probably seen before. He does a lot of the promotional videos for Stumptown. He also shot the intro to True Blood. Those are very, you know, distinctive of his style. Enjoy the interview. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
Originally from Michigan.
Okay.
Bounced around growing up. Colorado, California, Connecticut.
Wow, why so much bouncing?
No particular reason. I think it was just young parents, you know.
Okay.
You know, just checking out new things, different job opportunities, you know.
Okay. It was the 70s. Was it the 70s?
It was the 70s. Okay. Yeah. Nothing sorted.
Okay. Gotcha. Just free spirits.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long have you been in the Portland area?
Since 1995.
Okay. So you are a video guy. What's your title? What would you call yourself if someone asked you?
In the industry, I would be called a director of photography.
Okay. Where did you learn to do that? Where did this come from?
Where did it come from? Let's see. I don't know if it came from anywhere specific. I think it was partly born out of not being interested in very much of anything.
Okay.
And at a certain point, I thought, God, film production looks kind of cool. And that was the first thing in my life. And that was like at 24 or something like that. I finished school and... You know, I was waiting tables and kind of just thinking what was the next step. And so I jumped into some classes at the Northwest Film Center here in town and just kind of explored that. And from there, I got into the photographic side of that. And I was like, I just, you know, it was cool. I enjoyed the process and I kind of felt like I was okay at it, you know? Like I had, like, it was one of the first things I think that I recall feeling like, oh, I'm kind of good at this, like in maybe what I considered a meaningful sort of way.
Had an eye for it, kind of.
Yeah, or something, you know, enough to like spark my interest and curiosity. I was definitely like curious to like learn and watch and just kind of absorb as much as possible. So the interest, I think, just kind of stemmed from those, you know, those experiences.
So before that, you went to college, but it wasn't for film or anything like that?
No, just
what was it for?
Just a liberal arts English degree, you know, kind of keep it open.
Right. Is there someone who inspired you to do that, or was there a certain kind of...
I don't think there was, like, a person per se. I think, like... Definitely exposure to certain kinds of filmmaking was a huge turn on to me. Like, you know, lots of kind of more experimental avant-garde documentary stuff, stuff that was really interested in exploring form and with this idea that there's like, in a way, like all stories have already been told. The thing that makes each story a little bit different is how they're conveyed or how they're told. And that was super exciting for me, not just photographically, but editorially, and thinking about, you know, the creative process from that standpoint. And so here I am, like, at, you know, in my early 20s, just seeing like all of these avenues to explore creatively and just trying different hats on all the time. And it was super exciting to kind of, you know, simultaneously find your own voice within that, but also just kind of, you know, explore in a very sort of pure creative way. And that, you know, fueled my interest for years, I would say.
Just so when you started out, were you, what were you shooting on?
So like initially, like my first film projects were on Super 8.
Okay.
And that was, you know, that was through coursework at the Film Center. They had awesome teachers there who, you know, I would say as much as anybody were instrumental into, you know, turning me on to filmmakers that were doing things that I had never seen before,
mm-hmm.
and getting me to think in ways that were all of a sudden like igniting some just like curiosities and passion in myself. And that was just like, to have that happen to you in your life for the first time, it's like you just hold on to it like, you know, for dear life. It's like a life jacket. You're like, oh, here, finally something's come along that I like.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of ran with it as much as I could and you know, just worked at it.
You were shooting, editing all on Super 8, just like cutting film?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it was all very like, this was at the tail end, I would say, of entering into digital stuff, and albeit crappy digital stuff. This was the tail end of editing on flatbeds. So cutting everything still on film. You could certainly cut things on video, but in an educational setting that was still being promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that framework influenced, you know, the kind of work I was into. I think stuff that was really like, felt like something that had texture and things that you could hold on to. It had like a lot of physical substance and quality to it,
mm-hmm.
which was stuff that was, you know, again, like more experimental in nature, stuff that was maybe interested in alternative photochemical processes, or were really interested in these very formal structures editorially that, you know, we're trying to develop these internal languages within the films themselves and seeing how that those might have conveyed an idea or a story differently than maybe a more standard conventional approach.
Okay. Were these just a few minutes long? Like,
it was definitely like, in general, I think that kind of work was so much more well suited for the short film format.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think you bearing in mind someone else is watching what it is that you're, you know, you've put out there, the attention span for these kinds of things, I think, it's quite a bit less than a narrative-driven story that is an hour and a half long. And while there is certainly beautiful and compelling works that are super challenging to watch that take, you know, hours, an hour if not hours, to play out, I think by and large most of this kind of work is most digestible in the under 15-minute sort of format.
And was this black and white? Did you start in black and white, or did you just
I guess starting would only just be by virtue of, like, you know, that was like the requested, you know, stock to use maybe for some initial projects. But, you know, by no means was I compelled to just shoot in black and white or anything.
I see. And how long was it until you got commercial work?
A long time.
Okay.
So like, at a certain, let's see, in 1998, I did an internship at a local production company, and I quickly learned that I wanted nothing to do with working in the commercial industry. It just seemed like a dead end. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with what I was interested in, which was like I said before, kind of at that time geeking out on all these, like, you know, seeing how, I mean, what happens if you do this? What happens if you put this after this and slow this down, speed this up, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, just kind of fucking around to make things feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was looking around at some of the people who were working in the industry and seeing that after 20 years of hard work, you know, they were doing, like, you know, Bowflex ads or something like that. And at the time, that seemed very unattractive. Mm-hmm. Or it wasn't where I was, you mm-hmm. know? It just wasn't what I wasn't ready to jump into that boat quite yet. So I said, no, I don't think that's the track I'm gonna explore. So I found myself employed at the school that I went to, Northwest Film Center, basically running their equipment room for the next 7 years after that. And it was, you know, it facilitated those interests still. Like, the framework was set up to, like, continue, like, maybe working on my own stuff or working on other people's stuff. And that was really helpful to kind of start to, you know, like, get rid of this kind of aesthetic, or, you know, just kind of hone your own sort of personality a bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I felt like that was a super helpful thing. And then as far as, like, commercial entry work, it was very weird, and it was I shouldn't say it wasn't unintended. After working at the film center for that many years, I was like, well, this job is, like, fine, and I love the people here, and I love, like, what we're doing as an organization. But it wasn't a place that, or a job that I saw myself doing when I was 50. Mm-hmm. And kind of thought, okay, well, what's the best, you know, okay, if you could do what you want to do, what would you do? And the thought was, well, if I can figure out in some shape, form, or another to make a living working on commercial projects that are in some shape, form, or another an echo of my personal work,
like more creative, yeah, kind of more,
yeah,
experimental.
Yeah, like they bring me on to do, like, something that is that I offer in my own work, you know. Then maybe I can enter into that conversation a little bit easier. And it wasn't like I was like, every project needs to be like that. Mm-hmm. It was more like I was thinking, like, well, if initially, like, maybe if 2 out of every 10 projects mm-hmm. has, like, something that I can grab onto and feels like, you know, it's coming from a good place for me, then, you know, I can, that'll be a goal for me to, like, you know, work towards. And so, you know, at that point, you're just like, you're just taking whatever that comes your way. You're, mm-hmm. you know, I remember I did, like, a feature length slideshow for, like, this doctor in Beaverton who's, like, he wanted to do, like, art therapy and show, like, his snapshots from travels around the world, and it was called a video safari, and, you know, everything about it is about on par with what the name of the piece suggests. It really was, like,
how did you find a client like that type of client?
I don't know. They called me. Yeah, okay. You know, at that point, you know, it's just like, if the phone rang,
yeah,
awesome. And still to this day, if the phone rings, awesome.
Yeah.
I'm not that much pickier today than I was then, in a sense.
Fair enough.
So, you know, I did that kind of stuff for a year or so, and then an old friend from the film center, who I hadn't talked to in years, he called me up and said, hey, I work at this production company up in Seattle. I remember really liking your work. Send us, you know, some work samples. And I was like, cool. And so I sent them that, and it was ended up being a job for the introduction for HBO program series True Blood, and this is the company that did the title sequence for it, and that was well received by audiences and within, you know, the company that produced it, and that kind of, you know, that sparked something. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden, like, I was like, you know, they called me a few more times, you know, things started to kind of creep from there. And it wasn't like, you know, all of a sudden overnight, like, Trevor, get an agent, you know, like, let's go. We work to do. It was still very like, I was still teaching at the Film Center, and I did that for a couple more years. And
just saying, you hadn't decided what to wear on the runway yet.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. You know, or at the award show, you know,
it's right.
Too much stress. So yeah, I mean, long story short is True Blood opening title sequence helped generate future work and kind of on some level helped spawn a lot of the commercial work that I'm doing today. And twofold, I should say that, you know, the work from that I did for True Blood honestly was generated from some of the early work that I did for Stumptown. Stumptown Coffee Roasters, and you know, that's a huge, huge part of my identity.
Mm-hmm.
The work for them.
So at this point, when you're doing the intro to that show, for example, are you still doing it on film?
Yep. So okay. All my contributions. I was the co-DP for that job. And all of my contributions were either on 16mm or Super 8.
Okay.
And that was, you know, a format that I still continue to work with sometimes, you know, whenever I can, if it's appropriate for the project.
Is it typically a question of budget or the right sort of visual aesthetic for the project or
at this
time?
Point, both, yeah. Especially budget. It's more and more expensive to be able to work in that medium, and
sorry, everyone.
That's all right. And creatively, it's appropriate. Sometimes it's not.
When you do that, are you editing it digitally? Do you do the transfer then the editing?
Yeah, and I'm doing nowadays. Very little editing these days.
Okay.
You know, I'm handing off all of the materials and never seeing it.
Okay.
Until it's finished. More often than not, except for anything that I'm fully producing, mm-hmm. which at this point is mostly just the Stumptown work.
Okay.
And maybe an occasional thing here and there. But by and large, I'm just shooting and never seeing it again. Until it's finished.
Until it's up.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, the Super 8 and 16 is processed, sent to a facility that transfers it and puts it in a digital file format that then's ingested into an editorial setup.
Okay. Yeah, your relationship with Stumptown has been amazing to watch. How many videos have you done so far?
In some shape, form, or another, like for different applications and purposes, you know, there's probably a good 12 or 15 that are out there. You know, some are for educational, mm-hmm. some are for event-specific scenarios, mm-hmm. and then a handful are standalone, like short pieces.
It seems like for a while there, you were doing kind of going on source trips, like visiting the countries where they're like to shoot them, you know, harvesting and tell me about that. What was that like?
It's tremendous. I would say it's one of the most important experiences that I've had.
Yeah.
I would say that in 2006, the first time I went to a coffee farm, Finca El Injerto in Guatemala, and I traveled with my partner on a lot of these films, Autumn Campbell, and at that time, Dwayne Sorensen. It was like one of those light bulb moments that you have, you know, hopefully you have, of kind of looking around your what's going on and acknowledging, like, this is really what I want to be doing. And it wasn't until that point that I knew that I wanted to be in different places outside of Portland, meeting new people and seeing new things behind the lens of a camera, as not just as like a creative experience and gathering elements to put together for films, but also as much as anything just for like an experiential sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like just so awesome to be able to engage in conversations, not verbal conversations, but just some sort of interaction with people from the framework of photographing versus being, say, like a traveler or a tourist. Mm-hmm. And it all of a sudden it opened up these doors to those experiences that I hadn't experienced before as a tourist. And that was like, that just was so rich feeling to me. And
were you comfortable having a camera around?
Super
there?
Comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seem like that it was.
I have no. I mean, every culture is different in terms of how receptive they are to being photographed. Some, like, you know, it runs the gamut.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm not uncomfortable pointing a camera at somebody. And it's either one of two things. You can either just. You feel the vibe that's telling you to be more sensitive, at which point you make yourself come across as being sensitive to the situation, either physically or verbally. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, if your presence isn't wanted, it's easy to pull back. You know, there's no like, it's very rare that there's content or an instance where it feels like it's so demanding that you have to, you know, contradict somebody's suggestive or explicit request for you not to be there photographically.
Right.
It's an easy sort of scenario to navigate.
And how long on a trip like the Ellen Hertel trip that you mentioned, like, how long are you there? How many days are you shooting?
So a short period of time. So that's like usually 3 to 4 days.
Okay.
And I think, like, in that respect, one of the things that was always important and maybe still is today is that when you're putting together material based upon those short excursions, that you're putting together content that reflects actually that time frame that you're working in that you're not trying to suggest your intimacy or knowledge or understanding of what's going on there any more than what one would be able to absorb in those number of days.
Okay.
And so, like, for that respect, from that aspect, it's like, I always felt like it was our responsibility to invite the viewer into like how a place looks and how it feels and how it sounds. And, try to kind of keep it in that mindset. And not be overly, I don't know what the words are, but, you know, not try to suggest that you understand what's happening there more than what you could actually understand within that framework. I certainly would say, like, early on, especially with the first handful of films, it was really kind of, maybe to a fault, was really
Let me ask you this: do you mean like you maybe wouldn't film yourselves hanging out having dinner or doing the part? You'd film more like them, like people at work or like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, I think it's really interesting to incorporate, you know, a filmmaker's participation within, you know, the framework of the thing that they're shooting. I wasn't, you know, I. For these projects, I wasn't interested in exploring that. This was always more about trying to, like, convey what it was like, to pick carry processed coffee and what the locations looked like and who the people were and what they exuded in some shape, form, or another. And it always felt like it was almost better to do it in a more open-ended sort of way, mm-hmm. versus in being very explicit. Because, you know, one thing that's always challenging is communication, you know? It's like, you're kind of like, you're dealing with folks on a, maybe a more superficial level at that point, and you're just kind of going off of gut interactions and and so, you know.
So on that first trip, are you, you're shooting film, at least for that first one?
Film and video, yeah.
Okay, okay. Yeah. And is there any concept of, like, dailies? Are you able to review your footage at the end of the day, or are you just kind of hoping you got what you need? No, you're so
like, after 12 hours of shooting, you're just kind of like...
in the sun.
Yeah.
You're just kind of wiped out.
Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah, and it's nice to kind of, you know, not have to look at stuff unless you need to.
Yeah.
And just kind of let it digest and come back to it after you return, if the project allows that.
And so, jumping forward to the most recent project, is that something that you were still shooting with film, or is that mainly a video?
It's mainly video. Yeah, you know, I think it's you know, like, I'm trying to think the last time I shot. Actually, the I shot two projects in the fall. I shot film for it, but I never processed it because of the like expense of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew I just didn't necessarily need it.
Yeah.
It was like bonus material.
Are you shooting nowadays when you do video? Is it with a video camera, or are you using a regular, like a digital camera?
Well, certainly like the last 3 years have been super DSLR heavy.
Yeah.
With like, you know, when Canon 5D hit the, or, you know, hit the market, it just kind of, it changed the landscape of commercial filmmaking in a really profound way. And it like just, it really like, for me, it was just like just a game changer too. It broadened my palette exponentially and just got me super jazzed and excited about photography again.
Okay.
You know, I was shooting, you know, mostly like 16 before that and standard definition video, and it was fine. But all of a sudden, what, you know, some of the creative choices that were allowed with a DSLR, all of a sudden, you know, really, it gave you that many more decisions or creative choices to make when putting a shot together.
Well, give me an example of
So, like, all of a sudden, with a DSLR, you were shooting with a camera that had a very cinematic quality, i.e., shallow depth of field,
okay,
which is a property that most people are familiar with, whether they know it or not, when they watch a motion picture, where your backgrounds are out of focus considerably compared to your foregrounds or vice versa.
Okay.
So this idea of selective focus was a huge thing all of a sudden to consider.
Mm-hmm.
The form factor of the cameras, they're super small. They all of a sudden like really facilitated documentary filmmaking in a way that was you know, a little bit less obtrusive than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of a sudden, I think, made people more comfortable who you were shooting in documentary situations. And, you know, mostly those two things just kind of optioned more considerations of how you wanted things to look.
Yeah.
I think lensing all of a sudden became a much more important thing to me. It used to be like, you know, when I was used to shooting 16, it was all just kind of like, make a beautiful frame, done, you know, make a nice composition or, you know, have it be whatever it is. But it was just like, whatever was in front of the camera, that was the end of my conversation.
Yeah.
But now it's that and a couple other things, you know, and that's just, you know, like anybody, as they learn more about their craft, they have more to bring to the table, and I think like that helps speed that conversation along for me, like in a huge and important way that's been, you know, super cool for me.
Do you feel like when you're working with people these days, because you have so much of a body of work behind you, that they kind of know what they're getting, you don't have to sell yourself as much?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, thankfully, I feel super fortunate in that respect. And like I was saying before, it's like, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, I'm a gun for hire for commercial projects, and I rely on the phone to ring. And, you know, I take work wherever it comes in whatever shape, form it is. And if things are slow and Bedmark comes by and is like, hey, we want to do a commercial, I'm like, you know, cool, awesome. I'm happy to be work. I have overhead that takes precedence over my creative sort of wishes and curiosities and pursuits, to be honest. Yeah. But having said that, I feel like my patience in my earlier years of not stepping into production work and kind of climbing a ladder of, you know, just getting to a position where somebody was going to pay you to shoot something, was a gamble that paid off in that I developed a voice, I think, that people have subsequently, and it's been more and more as time goes on, have come to me to bring on to project. They know that, like, my style is like, it's definitely like documentary in approach, and hopefully it has some refined qualities that make it a bit more than, you know, something that looks haphazard, as if somebody was just picking up a camera and going out there and, you know, hitting record.
Right. If someone was going to trevorfife.com and you were going to tell them, you know, you watch this one piece, yeah, that's my style in a nutshell, what would that be?
The style in a nutshell is, in the best case scenario, is a synergy that happens between a very formal and emphasis on composition in terms of photographic style that editorially is combined with a very organic and seemingly unrefined and raw sensibility that, when put together, hopefully creates a synergy. I really believe in there being a sense of intention behind how you're expressing something and how you're photographing something, and especially even how you're editing something. And so when I go out, I like to at least like breathe intention or reason into like why it is I'm doing the thing that I'm doing, why it looks the way it does, and that it has, you know, some sort, it's grounded in some sort of like approach, and with an intended result. Not to say that you get that, but, you know, at least to like kind of get the conversation going.
Do you ever have discussions with clients who push back and wonder why you made a particular shot?
No. Do you feel most of my conversations are with directors.
Okay.
With the directors, my job really is to facilitate the creative vision that they have. And so in the best case scenario, I'm asking them questions that get them to explain or expand or question, you know, some of the question or the, where they're at in the project. And yeah, hopefully that, you know, pushes the project into a better place than where it was, or, you know, me just better understanding what their vision is and being able to do my job in a better way.
When you're shooting something that you're also going to be editing, like this recent Stumptown work, for example, are you more or less comfortable in that situation? Do you find it more challenging to come up with what you're going to shoot without that direction?
No, I mean, I think, you know, like because that's, you know, where my interests kind of lie in a more global sense is, yeah, is when I'm hired to shoot something, I'm, you know, I'd like to think that I'm conscientious about not just how things are appearing in the frame, but I'm thinking about things editorially. So yeah, making sure that, you know, it's, that they're getting the elements that they're going to need to work with, mm-hmm, and thinking about how things are going to ultimately look beyond just what we're seeing in each individual shot. So, what was the question?
Well, you know, I mean, I was wondering if you were equally comfortable in both roles.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So to that end, it's like I love directing. I try to get like upstream in the conversations as much as possible, so that, because I feel like the shooting, and especially the kind of projects that I work on, photographically, it informs the edit a lot, and making sure that the photographic elements are there for the edit, I think it always is important, but I think for whatever reason in the projects that I work on, it's maybe even more important.
Okay.
So it's almost like doing diligence to my own work and you know, thinking that that my contributions might help the edit if we get our bases covered. It's hard for me to describe.
Well, with the most recent Stumptown one is a good example, where the format was kind of focused around a series of interviews.
Yeah.
I would describe it as.
Yep.
And but sort of filled with a lot of little visual asides and vignettes and little stories like over that. So tell me about your process for making that. Did you start with the interviews and then kind of have the story in your head, what you were gonna shoot, and then just sort of set out to get all of that footage?
Yeah, very much like that.
Okay.
So all the interviews were conducted, more or less, I'd say 3/4 of them were conducted within a few days.
Okay.
And then from there, I put together just like an audio narrative. And from there, it's like that starts to invite some editorial ideas and what kind of visual content you'll need. And then just kind of piecemealing from there. Okay. And then filling in holes wherever need be.
So you work in iMovie?
No.
I'm actually curious, is it like Final Cut?
Final Cut.
7 or 10?
7.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I was an editor, like professionally, maybe I would edit in 10, but only because maybe that's what I would need to do professionally. But I know plenty of professional editors who are still editing in 7.
Yeah.
For those of you who are remotely interested in that kind of thing, it's Final Cut 7 is just A-okay with me, and I thought they kind of. They missed big time on the Final Cut 10, in my opinion.
So, what's next for Trevor? What are you excited to be working on next? What kind of, I mean, where do you see your career going from here?
I just came off of one of the better jobs in the last few years, shooting content for. I think that's a new LAX, either it's like a terminal or a new wing or something like that, or new sort of thing. And inside the terminal, there's all of these like huge, large scale kind of architectural video panels that are in like these kind of odd shaped configurations, very kind of like design oriented. Some of them are computer generated in terms of the content, but there's one section, there's this 8-panel video wall that is going to consist of these 6-minute portraits of cities around the world. And so we just finished shooting content for Barcelona, Bangkok, and Seoul. And like it was like one of those like dreamy jobs, because there was really no
location.
It was in a fun place to shoot. There was no client there, and the creative was just like wide open. Shoot what's cool.
Mm-hmm.
With a few, you know, with some very creative, like, you know, point of references and how to, you know, make something tangible from it. But it was a very kind of like, you know, just go do something cool kind of job, which in theory could spawn into repeated shoots for 22 more cities if it's well received.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be in the future. you know, the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. Other future things, I would say, like, you know, it's still like I haven't done a personal project in years.
Mm-hmm.
Partly out of like just, you know, being much more interested in commercial work,
mm-hmm.
and simultaneously the commercial work actually really feeding a lot of the like personal creative interests. So it hasn't been any kind of like, you know, struggle or conflict. I've been very content with commercial work satisfying personal work. But, you know, I would love to, you know, work on something that just kind of had no attachments to anything other than personal interests and you know, whatever kind of comes up from that groundswell.
Edinburgh's at a good location.
It's all about location.
Have you been? You mentioned, I think you mentioned still photography in passing. Is that something you're also interested in? You've been playing around with, or
I don't play around with it. I love still photography. At times, I like it better than motion, you know, live action stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I love the nature of a still photograph and the dialogue that happens between a viewer in that context versus what happens between a viewer in a live action. I feel like the kind of things that I'm drawn to photographically, either live action or still stuff, is stuff that is a little bit more ambiguous and mood related. And I, you know, correctly or incorrectly, I always felt like still photography invites a relationship that viewers will engage with. Viewers, I think, are much more patient with a still photograph that doesn't have a quick read and certain meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like a viewer's patience with live action is like they're just like they're in and out so much quicker, and they just like they're not willing to engage with something that is a little bit more meditative or
a little bit
quieter.
Of a different nature. Like they, if they were staring at a still image in a video, they'd be like, what's wrong with it? It's not doing the thing it's supposed to do for
totally.
Me.
Totally. And I think like in live action stuff, a lot of the shots that I'm drawn to are, you know, they're still photographs. You know, they're images that very little is actually moving in the frame.
Mm.
And so I enjoy that quiet quality, and the slower the better in my book.
Okay. So are you going to be doing any work in 3D soon? I've got to ask these questions. I'm just curious what you're going to say.
No.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't know where to start. You know, it's like at this point it's do what you like and do what you get paid for. And
do you think there's any technologies out there that would get you excited, like those like red cameras or that camera?
Yeah,
that
like has... I shoot on red once in a while.
Okay.
or Alexa. It's all about what's the right tool for the project and what's the budget of the project and what's the creative vision of the project and just figuring out which camera is the best tool for the job. And you know, like I was saying before, a lot of my stuff is kind of documentary in approach, and higher end, you know, conventional commercial production cameras are not a great fit for those scenarios. So it's all project dependent. But as far as like new technology and like, I don't know exactly what's on the horizon beyond like 3D and focusless cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what's going to happen is the resolution is going to get better on cameras, and that conversation will only become meaningful as soon as the displays that feature this content can catch up with that resolution. So like everything now is 1080 HD,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of cameras that shoot at 4 and 5K,
mm-hmm.
but there's very few display options to be able to exploit that unless you're going to theatrical release.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're putting stuff on the web, you're just not going to see that kind of image quality difference, more or less.
Right.
But that's going to change eventually.
Eventually.
And at that point, then it'll be interesting to see how cameras respond and, you know, where that conversation goes. But yeah.
So someone visits your portfolio. They're just out of college, and they're like, "That's the kind of shit I want to do." What advice would you give them? How should they get started?
I think there's two sort of paths that I kind of like I would suggest to people. And not with any sense of expertise. It's only based upon my very limited experience, which is either one is just, you know, getting it really, you have to define what are your interests. What do you want to be doing, you know? And a lot of people want to be, they just want to be working in the industry, and they want to be just doing commercial work, you know? That's kind of like, that's the cherry right there. And maybe for somebody else, they want to be involved in some kind of like, they want to explore their personal creative approach to the medium a bit more. And I think you have to kind of define those a little bit before you set your path forward.
Mm-hmm.
If you're minded towards, you know, figuring out what your own personal voice is and being able to do commercial work in that framework, then I think you just have to, open yourself up to as much work as possible and just be a sponge to what's out there and spend as much time absorbing and doing your own, like creating your own voice. You just gotta work. I mean, you have to work. You have to be, you know, passionate and just be honest about what it is that you're interested in, what you want to do. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's very surprising. It just takes a lot of work, and you know, just follow your heart. You know, because I mean, you got to be kind of, you have to be honest with yourself, you know, in some shape, form, or another. I guess that's pretty, like, that covers a lot of territory. It's just being honest with yourself in some shape, form, or another. It's like, do you think you're doing the right thing? Do you think you're going to down the right path? Do you think this is making your life more interesting? You know, are you having fun doing this? Hopefully you're having fun, because then it'll make it a lot easier.
Totally agreed. Trevor, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Hooray.
So aside from trevorfife.com, your home on the internet, where else can people find you? Are you on Twitter?
You got an Instagram? I am so unsavvy when it comes to social media.
So trevorfife.com is the place to go.
Yeah.
You're on Vimeo.
I'm on Vimeo. I'm there mostly to embed into my website, but I am also on Vimeo.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Trevor.
Thanks, Ray.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Ray.
You hanging in there?
I am. Are you? That was a big sigh.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
All right.
I'm doing good. My sinus is a little bit, but, you know, I hope our listeners will kindly forgive us.
They're kind people.
Yeah. At least they, you know, are listening. If they're still listening, I like them. Yeah. Any music you'd like to talk about? Any web news?
I'm sure there's web news, but there... I've been excited this past week for one of my favorite singer-songwriters of the last like decade put out a new album on last Tuesday, Josh Rouse, who has a new album called The Happiness Waltz.
Okay.
Which I've really been enjoying.
How do you spell his name?
R-O-U-S-E is his last name.
Okay.
Sort of like a poppy folk country. It was sort of where he came out of. I think he lived in Nashville for a long time. His first album came out in 98. It was called Dressed Up Like Nebraska. It had a really bunch of beautiful songs. There's a song on that album called The White Trash Period of My Life that is just stunningly beautiful and funny.
Okay.
you know, it's about sleeping on someone's couch in a double wide, I think. yeah, and he did an EP after that with Kurt Wagner from Lamb Chop, just to sort of give you a sense of like where he's coming from, and started putting out albums on Rykodisc a little while after that. And there was a period, 2002 to 2004, we put out three albums that were all really, really good. They had like some darker lyrical content mixed with this like almost aggressively upbeat kind of poppy folk. One album, the middle album in there, is called 1972, which is like intentionally sort of musically structured after like early 70s pop music, like radio pop.
Okay.
But the lyrics are kind of dark, and it gives it this really nice tension. And the album after that, Nashville, which is one of my favorites of his, sort of, you know, divorce album. It's very much a breakup album, but it's like really happy. Like the music and the lyrics kind of like are at odds with each other, but it makes for some really interesting listening.
Okay.
And then he moved to Spain and put out a few albums, and they've been good, but not, you know, not as exciting to me as those early ones. But then this album, I've only listened to it a few times in the past week, but it sounds a lot like Nashville, the album, Nashville, his album. It sort of has that same, like the lyrics are really interesting and kind of dark, but the music's like less Spanish influenced than the last couple, which it wasn't serving him real well, I don't think.
Right.
You know, a lot of less, you know, nylon string handpicked.
Oh, wow. Sound, okay.
Which, back to sort of the more straight ahead folk.
Right.
Which is, I've been enjoying it. I've only listened through it maybe three or four times, but.
Okay.
It's been good.
I was, I'm still getting through that Columbia 360, ebook, I guess. And, one of the things I was inspired to put together in Pandora was like a Bill Monroe sort of bluegrass mix.
Okay, yeah.
That was really nice in the mornings on our trip. So we had like a little jam box, so I just put on the Pandora and it would just blast and help everyone wake up, and kids liked it, which is good. It's heartening.
Yeah. Bluegrass, especially Bill Monroe style bluegrass is such a happy music. Like it's hard not to enjoy.
Pretty much every day we started the day with Bill Monroe and ended it with Beach Boys Today to get the youngest to sleep. Yeah, so that was nice.
It's a nice combo. Here is Appalachia, here is the West Coast. Like, right. There you go.
Yes, it was eclectic. And in between, a lot of Mary Poppins, because my older daughter is obsessed with that. She's going to be turning 4, and she's obsessed with Mary Poppins. One day, she wasn't feeling good. She watched the movie 3 times. It's not a short movie.
In one day?
That's like an 8-hour session.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's like overlapping like 2 meals.
My daughter is about a year younger than yours, and she also like... there's the one thing she likes that week, and it's
totally
just like full on repeat. Lately, it's been the Muppet movie, the original Muppet movie, which is fine by me.
The original?
Yeah.
Wow. So okay.
I nice. Like those songs.
Yeah.
I like that movie. It's nice.
That's a great movie.
Yeah.
Did you get that off iTunes, or do you have like the...
I think she's been watching it on Netflix.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
It's good to know.
Or Amazon Prime, like one of the streaming apps on the iPad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's changed, but when that new Muppet movie came out, it was like you couldn't find any of the old movies or any of the old shows anywhere.
The shows are still nowhere.
That's a shame.
I don't even think they're on DVD. Like, they're hard to find
yeah.
if they are. Because I remember we looked for them.
Like, Liz and My Daughter would love that show. I mean, just eat it up. Yeah. And I would appreciate it because they had cool guest stars, you know.
Steve Martin was on a lot.
Yeah. Even the and yeah, I mean, in the recent movie, there's like a couple, you get a couple glances at the old show. Like you see briefly that Peter Sellers was on one of them, and they mentioned great. Steve Martin. Yeah.
So is the Columbia book that you're reading, does that go through, like, does it end at a certain
I haven't period? Gotten to the end, but it starts at the formation of the company mm-hmm. when they were primarily just manufacturing like cylinder players or whatever. And
so you're what, like in the 40s now?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Just came into post-war.
So do you get in? Do you get to like Dylan?
No, we haven't gotten to Dylan yet. But, although the front page of the chapter I'm about to begin is a photo of Dylan. Okay, so
he's
I'm pretty confident we're going to get to Dylan in this chapter.
Nice.
But yeah, it's nice like hearing the sounds. Like they'll just randomly, when they're talking about someone, you can like play the clip. And then if it sounds good, I'll just sort of make a Pandora station. Nice. Like I'll listen to this. There's been a couple stations I've made. You know, I don't have to like invest. I'm not going to buy their whole catalog just from, but you know, maybe I will buy Bill Monroe album.
Were you a fan of Bill Monroe?
I did know Bill Monroe's okay. work. I was into bluegrass for a while, so yeah. You know, just kind of like there's just so much music out there. Sometimes you just forget that you like something, and mm-hmm. then you just one day you stumble across it again. That was a good excuse. Totally changing subjects here. A couple days ago, Apple announced that they were having a new marketing push for their pro apps. Did you read that?
No, I did not.
Basically, they came out with the new, and we talked about this a little bit just a bit ago in the interview that our listeners just heard, but Final Cut Pro 10 or X or whatever is pretty good, and it's getting better, and they've been improving it a lot, and they charge a lot less than they used to, but a lot of people have felt like Apple hasn't really been putting their full weight behind it like they used to. And, you know, the pro apps are important because I've always felt it was really smart to have the best video tools, because then it seems like you're more likely to be on the side who are creating the content that millions and millions of other people are going to see, and they're going to be likely to slip some Apple devices in there or, you know, or just be, you know, cognizant of Apple. And it's just good to be in the mind share of the pro market. Mm-hmm. It's good for your brand, especially Apple, who that's what their brand is all about. But conspicuously absent was the tool that I used to make this podcast, which is Logic Pro. So like they, in this new marketing push, they're like, yeah, we're really behind this new video editor, but the audio editor is like still isn't even Retina. Drive me crazy.
I can imagine that would drive you crazy, but that seems odd that you'd. Does Final Cut Pro, like, can you use that as a standalone audio app like you can with like iMovie or something?
I mean, you could theoretically, yeah. But it would be a world of disappointment. I think you'd have to put in some sort of dummy video that you weren't even using
and
to
then
do
just
that.
Basically pull out the audio track.
Ironically, you can actually edit video in Logic too. I mean, you can put a video track in there. And like if you're doing sound work for a commercial, you can actually do simple video editing. But so, I mean, if you go to apple.com/pro, they right there feature the three products that they're, let's just do that. the three basic like product lines that they push, and that's Aperture, which they have updated to Retina, and that's great. I use Aperture. Final Cut Pro, and then Logic, which is just kind of like they're not talking about it. There's been rumors for years that they're finally updating it, but nothing.
Is it that Final Cut Pro has like a built-in audience? Like that is like the default. If you're an editor, that's what you're using. And whereas like sound
a lot of
editors are probably using other applications, is it?
I would. So I would say that Final Cut has a larger market share in that sort of demographic than Logic. But that said, Logic is obviously very profitable, and they very explicitly bought it. I mean, you know, with all of these products, the thing about Apple is that they always have a consumer version that uses the same engine. So iPhoto uses Aperture. You're loading half of Aperture when you open iPhoto. It uses the same code base to process photos. That's why you can open your iPhoto library in Aperture and just work with it. And then vice versa. They're essentially the same format now. And Final Cut Pro, you can open iMovie. And Logic, you can open a GarageBand. But I noticed that GarageBand didn't get an update either. I suspect that their audio is just maybe behind the other guys.
Maybe in the fall.
I wish they would hurry up and update it. the marketing announcement that they made coincided with the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters. So maybe there's an equivalent audio show in which they're going to announce. The last thing that I heard was sometime late last year, there was some rumor going around that Apple had fired the whole Logic team, and someone from the Logic team like came out publicly in a tweet or email and said, nope, we're still working here, still have exciting things coming. So, but it's been like a couple of years and with the rumors, and you know, and I'm just kind of complaining. I have to do this because Apple doesn't respond to my angry tweets, no matter how hard I try.
That's just callous.
I know.
They need someone.
Just too big to...
You're just sitting there waiting for those. Okay. How often... What is the response rate on your angry tweets? Do you have any sense of that?
I have a pretty good response rate, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
so
I don't...
So it's effective.
It is. I'm probably selective when I... You know, I don't count Apple in my angry tweets because those are just, that's just regular complaining. That's just what I do. But, you know, if you know, there's a way that you craft it to get a response. You know, you don't want to tweet directly to them. You want other people to see it, you know, so forth. So you try to, like, request something reasonable.
I call them your angry tweets, but yeah, they're very rarely actually come off no, sounding angry. They're like, hey, I saw this thing that's not working.
Yeah, or if they were just pure anger, it wouldn't get anything done. People would just block me, but so far I don't think anyone's blocked me. Yeah.
Just another asshole on the internet at that point.
That's right. Yeah. Esquire. Great. So on that note, next week we're going to be chatting with Jen Armbrust of Armbrust & Company here in Portland about thinking about your career and how to make your career awesome. So join us then, and we'll see you then. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.